Hello and welcome back to the Faith and Race Podcast. I'm Connor Keniston, and today we have a special treat as we have two guests for this episode, Dr. Arnold Parks and Dr. John Wright. Arnold served as a sociology professor for many years at Lincoln University in Jefferson City, and now serves as the pastor of Paris Fork United Methodist in Fulton in St. Paul and New Bloomfield. Meanwhile, John worked for 42 years as a principal and teacher in the St. Louis public school system, and is a longtime member of Grace United Methodist Church in St. Louis. They co-wrote an excellent book in 2012, African American United Methodist Churches in Missouri, A Pictorial History. God will surely set you free. Why be afraid? God is able. As a heads up, this episode will deal specifically with Methodism, particularly the history of United Methodism, more so than most episodes. But I think it provides a unique case study into understanding the past and church institutions' relationship to faith and race. To really understand where this is all coming from, I think we have to go all the way back to Methodism's origins. At its very inception, the official stance of the Methodist Church was anti-slavery. This message of liberation made Methodism a huge draw for slaves and free blacks. The conservative estimate is that at least one-fifth of American Methodists in this era were black. Blacks were licensed as preachers and exhorters, and some, like Harry Hozier, who traveled with Francis Asbury, were known for being some of the best in the country. Unfortunately, segregation soon slipped in and became a part of the American religious fabric. Here's John describing Richard Allen and one of the ugliest moments in Methodist history.
You know why Allen left the church? They wouldn't let him even pray. They had a separate section. They said, unless you move, they were trying to pray and finish praying. And they said, well, just let us finish praying and we'll move. And they sent people to remove them. And so they walked out of the church. Now, there's a fight among the whites so they wouldn't leave because they were taking the money with them. So in spite of that, we want you, but we want you to sit in a certain section. Don't leave because you take your money. And so Allen set up the Black Methodist Church because he wasn't allowed to pray. And they had changed the place and wanted to move to another section. He went to the place where they had been. And so as a result of that, you end up with the Methodist Church.
So when Richard Allen in Philadelphia was told, you're not allowed to pray here at a
good service,
Old St. George's during the service, he and Absalom Jones left and formed
African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME. Actually, the AME Church, the CME Church, the AME Zion Church, they all came out of the Methodist Church.
So all of these churches have its roots in the original Methodist Church, so absolutely. We're all branches.
That's right. Okay. They weren't branches. They were persons who got disillusioned with what was happening in the Methodist Church, and say, "Well, I don't have to put up with this. I'm gone." And so they left and started their own denominations.
The second voice you heard, that's Arnold. Some of our interviewees in other episodes hail from those denominations that Arnold was just describing. Even though the denomination started officially anti-slavery, over the years, elements and people within the Methodist Church gradually started to weaken that stance. Ultimately, the Church Universal and certain scriptures played a major role in maintaining slavery, too. Here's John.
Reading last night, Nat Turner was saying the church was one of the biggest problems with long dealing with slavery, because the sermon said to the slaves, be obedient, be kind to your master, and all those things to keep slavery going. The missionaries went into the black community, and that was their theme. You should be obedient, you should respect your master and do what's requested. So the church played a major role in maintaining slavery.
Anti-slavery and pro-slavery tensions increased in the church and society until the Methodist Church formally split in 1844, creating the Methodist Episcopal Church and the Methodist Episcopal Church South. The country soon followed in 1861.
The country was divided. Civil War over slavery. You had part of the church believed there was nothing wrong with slavery, and the other part thought something was wrong with it. The Southern Methodists weren't anti-slavery. The Northern were more opposed to slavery. So it was this issue of slavery more than anything else. Mm-hmm. It was a money issue. Many of the Southern Methodists made their money off of slavery, and they didn't want to cut their gravy train off.
Almost 100 years after the split, the churches reunited to form the Methodist Church. However, unfortunately, as is often the case, unity brought compromise and sacrifices. And in the case of the 1939 merger, it was clergy women and African Americans who were sacrificed. In your book, you wrote, quote, "In 1939, the Methodist Church came into existence as a reunited denomination with an agreement to weave racial separation into the constitutional fabric of the new denomination." What did you mean by that? So what is the Central Conference? Why did it come about?
Well, the Central West Conference came about because of, because of segregation. It was a separate conference that was set apart from the larger church. And it was formed for that purpose, to as a separate body that was set aside for administrative purposes. It was set aside, and persons were appointed to select churches in that conference, and that's why it came to be.
So it functioned as a conference, just like the Missouri Conference does today. And yet all of the African-American clergy and churches were in this separate central jurisdiction.
Yes, it was. They were in that separate body. They were set aside in that separate body.
And in the book, you write that Black Methodists had overwhelmingly opposed the creation of the central jurisdiction. Why do you think they opposed the creation of it?
Well, we talk about separate but equal. This is why the Supreme Court 1954 decision dealt with the whole issue of separate but equal. I think they were opposed to it because they did not see that there was equality there, that it was going to be separate but equal with that segregated West Conference of Central Jurisdiction. They saw the handwriting on the wall that it was not going to be a separate but equal arrangement. And so I think that's why there was opposition there to that.
Do you know the financial breakdowns? Because it seems to me like the Central Conference had to cover the entire United States, whereas most of the white jurisdictional conferences were regional.
Absolutely.
So were they compensated more because they had to cover more ground, or no?
No, they not at all. They covered more ground, but did not get the resources to cover the ground that they needed to cover.
You learn to make do. You learn to
make a way out of nowhere.
You learn how to function without the resources, and so it's a different way of operating. Unless you're poor, you don't understand that. Poor folks understand. How you function with no money.
As John points out, the all-black conferences that composed the central jurisdiction, like Missouri's Central West Conference, had to make do despite limited means. One of the ways was by relying on relationships and a different mode of approaching what it means to do church. In the book, there are tons of instances of African-American churches starting in homes or storefronts. I should have seen their response coming when I asked them why they thought that was.
It's money.
Money. That's right.
Money. Some of the churches never had a building. And some of the churches, we couldn't find them, were located. But the church was small, but you had a circuit minister who went by. And so money is a big issue. If you have money, you build a nice edifice. But if you don't have the money, you go in a home, you go in a storefront, whatever you can find, the gospel.
Sounds like the gospel can take place in a lot of different places.
Absolutely.
Gotta love that laugh. That was definitely an advantage of doing an interview with two interviewees that had been friends for a long time. It's interesting, too. I think we're seeing a return to this idea in the 21st century as churches are moving away from grandiose buildings in an attempt to try to get back to the basics. Limited means for the all-black conferences also affected the way that the annual meeting of Methodists, known as Annual Conference, was run. Here's Arnold.
A lot of people, when they would go to annual conference in the Central West Conference, they stayed in homes. The churches provided the dinners, and people stayed in other people's homes. I can recall my family putting up persons who were coming into annual conference and giving them lodging. They didn't stay at a Holiday Inn. They stayed at somebody's house.
Similar to the nation at large, in the 1960s, the United Methodist Church finally legislated the end of segregation within the church's structure by integrating the central jurisdiction into the regional jurisdictions and conferences. In many ways, this was a major step forward because it was more equitable and it enriched the church beyond measure. It's interesting, though, because despite the obvious positives, it seems that something may have been lost as well.
And I have members who talk about annual conference, how different it is. Mm-hmm. It was a gathering with the African Americans. They came together, they looked forward to it. They met in, they stayed in homes, had dinners there. It's more formalized now, and you don't have that family style get together and people anxious to get back together to see each other, and it's just a gathering. It's just business more. We're going to do business, and you come up, and we're going to do some votes, and we'll give some reports, and you go home.
Sure. Central West Conference, the annual conference was the vacation for persons, the African-American persons who came to Central West Conference. They look forward to, once a year, coming together, as John said, for the social gathering. That was lost with integration because this was an opportunity for folks who were family to get together for an annual gathering.
I could tell as the interview went on that the book was a labor of love. It was an opportunity to tell stories that either hadn't been told or weren't going to be told. The names in the book weren't just names, but were individual humans. They were humans that had families and friends. They told stories. They had fears and doubts, convictions and dreams. And their actions helped create the world we have today. To discover these stories was beautiful, but I could tell that it was also a painful experience, as it highlighted a numerical decline in historically black United Methodist churches. Here's John.
Well, you know, I got to see people and meet people I had never seen before and been to some place I'd never been before or thought about going before. So it was an interesting experience. To document to see where we were and where we are today, in some cases it's frightening to see how much we've lost from 140-some churches down to about 35. So it's a history that needs to be captured because every time a church closes, the material just disappears. So it was a timely effort and timely project to do this while we were able to get some people while they're still living. When we were doing the book, I remember one community I called the church, and the pastor said he'd been there for years. He spoke with one of the members who was well in her 90s. She doesn't even remember when blacks used to be in the community. So we began to see that we've lost history, and it never got recorded because no one took the time and people moved. Many of the churches were established after slavery, and people stayed in the community. But as the population aged and the kids left, the churches died, and there's no one there to take over the ministry. So we learned a lot about the population, the shifts. Some churches have combined. I remember I went to Truesdale. They told me, look for the building. It was a tall, weathered building. I was on the street, and the guy said, what are you looking for? He said, it was in that spot. It was gone. I was told about another one in Lee Summit. It says a gray building, weathered building. You go down the road, got to the place, church had been torn down, was gone. So you ran into those types of things where buildings disappeared, no longer there. Populations were gone and no history written.
I think the one story that it's struck with me is how we've had such a decline. You mentioned the figure, we went from over 100 churches now down to 35. It's just phenomenal how we've had such a drop in the number of African-American churches over the years and how they're just going out of existence.
This is a tough message to hear. Yes, mainline churches have declined in general over the last 50-plus years, but why have historically black United Methodist churches in Missouri declined at a faster rate than historically white churches? Was it simply underfunding, changing communities, expectations of cultural assimilation, an increase in multicultural churches? Honestly, I don't know, but I think it's worth looking into to see how we can have a more equitable system going forward. And yet, there were also many inspiring stories that came out of the book. One of the fascinating things reading through Arnold and John's book was seeing all the ways that these historically black churches were involved in mission, service, and being a positive force in their community.
Because of segregation, the church was the social life of the African-American community. So everything took place there. Sometimes you had movies there, you had dances there, you had contests, and some on Sundays, church was all day.
It's clear that the church was central to African-American communities across Missouri. And I'm not saying that all churches need to have programs for everything, but I'd certainly say that being that positive community is a great example of what it means to be the church. One of the things I continued to notice was the frequency at which African-American churches in John and Arnold's book burned down due to fire. Here's John when I asked him why he thought that was.
Depends on what the preacher was preaching sometimes. If you didn't want voter registration, you didn't want getting involved in politics, and sometimes you had fire coal stoves, wooden stoves, and so that could be a problem too.
I think what John has said, some of the fires were intentionally set, seriously, they were, by the folks in the community, whereas others were just because of the structures themselves. I look at one of the churches I pastor, and I can still see the flue covered up. I'm sure they had a wood stove in there, and I'm sure a lot of the churches, those little small churches, had wood stoves, and the church caught fire. Intentional, unintentional.
So how does that legacy and that history affect the way that you interpreted the fires a couple months ago in St. Louis? There were I think six or seven African-American churches that were burned to some extent, either the door or sometimes the whole front of the church. How does that legacy interpret the way you view those events?
Business as usual. You know, you got communities involved and you have some individuals really want to set off a race war. That's their whole intention.
I think the story of the fires is an example of why history is important. Why the black church burnings across the country in the wake of removing the Confederate flag and later in St. Louis echoed so deeply in these communities. Now, were there any instances that you saw of black and white working together?
Well, throughout history, you had that to a certain extent. Even in slavery time, you had blacks and whites working together. So it's more pronounced in certain communities than other communities. Some churches, the choir and the pastor changed back and forth, but that's little projects off and on have been throughout the history of the church.
And sometimes those little projects were important because they led to bigger projects. Or sometimes they were important because they simply led to the recognition of the other's humanity. The imago Dei, the image of God, in someone who looks different. An interesting dynamic that is rooted in history but continues today is a separateness between churches in the same community, sometimes just down the road. For Methodist in particular, it's strange because our church is built on this word called connectionalism. We're all interrelated, and yet sometimes it seems that those threads of fabric are not always woven as tightly as they perhaps could or should be. Here's Arnold on that very idea.
The other factor is that the church where I pastor, one of the churches that I pastor, St. Paul United Methodist Church in New Bloomfield, within walking distance down the street is New Bloomfield United Methodist Church. One white, one black. Certainly the members of both churches grew up in the same neighborhood, and they knew each other, and they still know each other. But you have two Methodist churches, United Methodist churches, within walking distance of each other, but never the twain shall meet.
In your personal experiences of understanding and experiencing race, racism, racial justice, and reconciliation, what would you say the role of your faith has had on your life? Do you have any particular experiences that you'd like to share?
Oh, a bunch of them. I mean, there's no way that you can not have grown up black. and not had some of the experiences I know that I've had over the years growing up. Some of the day-to-day experiences you have in coming in contact with persons and people view you differently. Living in the neighborhood with somebody, and then once they got of age, the next person's going on, and then they don't know them anymore.
I had an experience with the Salvation Army at 16. I was one of the delegates, the only out of 255 of the African American for an international conference. Once I crossed the river going to Illinois, it was like going into freedom. Of course, we got to Chicago, stayed in any hotel you wanted to. It taught me that there are a lot of good white folks out there. They're not all like the United States. And that's heavy, because many people don't. They only see the whites in this country and live in communities where there's a lot of hatred. But to be able to stay in a home, to eat at a table, where you know there's a lot of decent people in the world. And so you begin to see the world in different. When you come back home, just like Malcolm X when he went to Mecca, he found a whole different world and came back a changed person. Traveling will do that for you. I think that was a church experience that I had. Going to that conference, that was a life-changing experience.
I rounded out the interview by asking both John and Arnold what message they would like you to leave with. So here it is, and I think it's an important one.
I would say recognizing the mission of the church. Be Christ-like. To treat others as you'd like to be treated. Remember you're Christians, whose you are and whose you are. If we keep the mission of our faith before us, it becomes easier. We have Christianity as our faith, and that's the model we need to go forth with to build this church.
I would echo what John says. I think that there needs to be a dialogue with others, and to open an open dialogue, an honest and open dialogue with others, and to have some open discussions, but some sincere openness with others and dialogue with others. I think that's what needs to happen.
If you want to engage in that honest and open dialogue that Arnold's talking about, a good place to start would be the Faith and Race Small Group curriculum. You can find it online or order it simply by emailing me at ckeniston, C-K-E-N-A-S-T-O-N, at mou-methodist.org. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next week for my interview with Dr. Leah Gunning Francis about her book, Ferguson and Faith. The Faith and Race podcast is a production of both the Center for Social Empowerment and Justice in Ferguson, Missouri, and Mission, Service, and Justice Ministries of the Missouri Conference of the United Methodist Church. Special thanks to Aubrey Jones, Nikki and Jason Reinhardt Swerk, Willis Johnson, Kim Jenny, Rachel and Diane Keniston, Maria Nee Shadowitz, Jordan Rudinis, Ivan James, Fred Koenig, Jeff Baker and the MSJ staff, and many others. The In-N-Out music is Mark Miller's beautiful composition, God is Able, which is based on a prayer by Martin Luther King Jr. Peace be with you, and see you next week.